Welcome to the Yokoji Zen Mountain Center podcast. Every month, we share at least one new talk on the practice of Zen Buddhism at cmc.org/podcast. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, and all other podcast apps. If you find these talks to be valuable, please consider supporting Yokoji by donating at cmc.org/donate. We rely on your support to continue sharing this life-changing practice. Thank you. We hope you enjoy the talk.
Good morning, afternoon and evening, depending on your time zone. Today, you know, I mentioned I was going to give a talk on the Fukan Zazengi. I'm using the Japanese title because the English title is a lot longer. It's the universal promotion of Zazen, you know. So obviously, it's really good to go back to basics. There's some background behind this. This is one of the fascicles that Master Dogen brought back with him from China when he was over there, and apparently, it originated as one of the Tendai schools. Meditation manuals, probably done by an old master called Jie A, who was a contemporary, apparently, of Master Bodhidharma in the 5th century. But then he did a couple more versions of it, and this is the second version of the same piece. So it's a fairly concise piece of writing. It's just 2 pages, and it basically has the heart of Zazen. It has the method, and it also has the intrinsic aspects to it. So anyway, I will read it, and then, you know, can discuss it. Okay. Fukan Zazengi. The way is basically perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent upon practice and realization? The Dharma vehicle is free and untrammeled. What need is there for man's concentrated effort? Indeed, the whole body is far beyond the world's dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from one right where one is. What is the use of going off here and there to practice? And yet, if there is the slightest discrepancy, the way is as distant as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. Suppose one gains pride of understanding and inflates one's own enlightenment, glimpsing the wisdom that runs through all things, attaining the way and clarifying the mind, raising an aspiration to escalate the very sky. One is making the initial partial excursions about the frontiers, but is still somewhat deficient in the vital way of total emancipation. Need I mention the Buddha, who was possessed of inborn knowledge? The influence of his 6 years of upright sitting is noticeable still. Or Bodhidharma's transmission of the mind seal? The fame of his 9 years of wall sitting or wall gazing is celebrated to this day. Since this was the case with the saints of old, how can people of today dispense with negotiation of the way? You should therefore cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illumine yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will be manifest. If you want to attain suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. For Sanzen, a quiet room is suitable. Eat and drink moderately. Cast aside all involvements and cease all affairs. Excuse me. Do not think good or bad. Do not administer pros and cons. Cease all movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha. San Zen, or penetrating Zen, has nothing whatever to do with sitting or lying down. At the site of your regular sitting, spread out thick matting and place a cushion above it. Sit either in the full lotus or half lotus position. In the full lotus position, you first place your right foot on your left thigh and your left foot on your right thigh. In the half lotus, you simply press the left foot against your right thigh. You should have your robes and belt loosely bound and arranged in order. Then place your right hand on your left leg and your left palm facing upwards on your right palm. Thumb tips touching. Thus, sit upright in correct bodily posture, neither inclining to the left nor to the right, neither leaning forward or backwards. Be sure your ears are on the plane with your shoulders and your nose in line with your navel. Place your tongue against the roof of your mouth, with teeth and lips both shut. Your eyes should always remain open. You should breathe gently through your nose. Once you've adjusted your posture, take a deep breath, inhale and exhale. Rock your body left and right and settle into a steady, immobile sitting position. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. The Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It is simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It is the manifestation of ultimate reality. Traps and snares can never reach it. Once its heart is grasped, you are like the dragon when he attains the water, like the tiger when she enters the mountains. For you must know that there, in Zazen, the right Dharma is manifesting itself, and that from the very first, dullness and distraction are set aside. When you arise from sitting, move slowly and quietly, calmly and deliberately. Do not rise suddenly or abruptly. In surveying the past, we find that transcendence of both unenlightenment and enlightenment and dying while either sitting or standing have all depended entirely on the strength of Zazen. In addition, the bringing about of enlightenment by the opportunity provided by a finger, a banner, a needle, a mallet, the effecting of realization with the aid of a hosu, a fist, a staff, or a shout, cannot be fully known by practicing or realizing of supernatural powers either. It must be deportment beyond persons hearing and seeing. Is it not a principle that is prior to her knowledge and perceptions? This being the case, intelligence or lack thereof does not matter. Between the dull and sharp-witted, there is no distinction. If you concentrate your effort with single-mindedly, that in itself is negotiating the way. Practice realization is naturally undefiled. Going forward in practice is a matter of everydayness. In general, in this world and in other worlds as well, both in India and China, equally hold the Buddha seal. And overall prevails the character of this school, which is simply devotion to sitting, total engagement in immobile sitting. Although it is said that there are as many minds as there are people, still they all negotiate the way solely in Zazen. Why leave behind the seat that exists in your home and go off aimlessly into other dusty realms of other lands? If you make one misstep, you go astray from the way directly before you. You have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not use your time in vain. You are maintaining the essential workings of the Buddha way. Who would take wasteful delight in a spark from a flintstone? Besides, form and substance are like the dew on the grass, destiny like the dart of lightning, emptied in an instant, banished in a flash. Please, honored followers of Zen, long accustomed to groping for the elephant, do not be suspicious of the true dragon. Devote your true energies to a way that directly indicates the absolute. Revere the person of complete attainment who is beyond all human agency. Gain accord with the enlightenment of all Buddhas. Succeed to the legitimate lineage of the Buddha ancestors, samadhi. Constantly perform in such a manner, and you are assured of being a person such as they. Your treasure store will open of itself, and you will use it at will. Okay. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot in that. It's a very condensed piece of writing. You know, if I'm to sort of look at this piece, I can look at it with several what I would call keys. So if you use that, then that will help in terms of the understanding of the rest of it. And in this case, I've got to find the line. Where are we? Practice realization is naturally undefiled. Going forward in practice is a matter of everydayness. So this practice realization, this is a mark of Master Dogen's teachings. So he doesn't split the two up like most of us do. We like having, you know, if I practice very diligently on the one hand, then the result will be realization on the other hand. There, but he's going. We'll cut out the middleman, you know. Practice realization. They're one thing. They're one and the same. And this is a mark of the majority of Dogen's teachings. And he's one of the very few teachers in the whole of the Zen tradition that really puts it in this way. Many people would have the same realization. But the thing is that he really emphasizes this point because he hears this same thing. You know, I am practicing and I will end up over there as an enlightened person, you know. And then you get people like my teacher going, well, somebody says, are you enlightened? And he goes, no, I am thoroughly deluded. You know, so what is that? You know, these are words. But there's, you know, there's also meaning in those statements is that enlightenment in itself is a word. You know, every language has its own word for enlightenment. The Western group of languages has a very similar word, you know, slightly different in German, French, English, you know, etc. But it all points to something. We always have to remember is that words are a pointer to direct experience. Enlightenment basically, as an experience, is shedding your light on this, not that over there at some other time, because that's the thing that creates suffering in us as human beings. Now, if we go back to the beginning, this key will kind of show you how, you know, Master Dogen actually thinks and feels. Now, it is said that there are about 18 what's known as case koans. In this particular fascicle. And so, you know, a koan basically is a question that we have as a human being, and we have to pass it for ourselves. It helps if we have help of a teacher along the way. And these also then open a condensed piece of writing into something that begins to hit many other aspects of our living. Now, Master Dogen starts off with a question that he had. He apparently became a monk when he was 11. You know, I don't know many people in this country that do that kind of thing. And most people get interested round about, you know, late teens. But, you know, I think it sort of ran in the family. His uncle was a Tendai teacher. So this is what came up for him. The way is basically perfect and all-pervading. Now, can we say that the word perfect in the English language is somewhat loaded? You know, because each of us has our own version of what perfect is. You know, and if you talk to people around perfection, then they will have different views of it. That in this case, it's like it is the way it is. It can't be changed. So look at that. There's perfection in isness in itself. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? Now that's really interesting because you've got two aspects that he's referring to, but you've also got, say, the Buddha's first statement where he becomes awakened and he says, "Wonder of wonders, I, all beings, the great earth, are the wisdom and virtue of the awakened one to thusness." So that's the koan of Buddhism, but it's also there's that perfection that's here right from the start. But you know, you look at that statement, and how many of us can really swallow it? You know, in a true way. You know how, you know, well, yeah, everything's enlightened. I'm good. Yeah, don't need to do anything else about it. And so, you know, he starts off with this, and he expands on it. He goes, the Dharma vehicle, or Dharma basically means things, and the world is full of things. It also means the truth of things, and that's always manifested. Now it says untrammeled. Now that's interesting because I know the word trammel from carpentry. Not many people even in carpentry know it, but what it is that, you know, it's a bit like a compass, you know. But what it is you've got two points, and you can just do it with a stick of wood if you want, put two points in it, and that will make a circle if you put one in the ground. It would do that. Now, with trammels, they are just the pointy parts, and, you know, you can say that you can have an infinite trammel, basically. If you had a stick long enough that would go to infinity, then, you know, that would be untrammeled because there's no ways that you can define it as a space. And so, you know, he's saying here about this great Dharma that we all practice. When the vehicle is free, well, we don't have to pay for it to start off with. Although, you know, if many of our banking services got hold of it, they would try and find a way of charging you for something that you already have. You know, they try to charge you for water and air and all that kind of stuff nowadays. But again, you know, is that there's nothing that is holding this in. Our senses go as far as they go, and there's no determining on what size that is. Quite often we forget that. You know, we think that my practice ends here. I'm okay now, or I am struggling. You know, it's kind of interesting. I was thinking about New Year, and I was sending out a prayer, as I often do, and it started off being selfish. You know, like I hope, you know, I can have a really good year, and then it's just like, well, no, you know, it really should be. And it feels like it should be for everybody because we're in this together. And if, you know, if it's a good year for all of us, we have a better year, you know, in that respect. And again, it's that untrammeledness. Just let your desires for a better world, let them really expand and allow your functioning to expand along those lines. And then, you know, he goes on, and this first line or so is that's Dogen Zenji's personal koan. The second is it goes in, what need is there for a person's concentrated effort? Now I hear this in spirituality all over. You know, it's, oh, I don't need to do anything, you know. And on one level it's true. But unfortunately what happens is we tend to define it. And it stays as a spiritual thing rather than going into all spheres of our activity. You know, it just tends to stay somewhat partial. And for many of us, we know in whatever arts that we do is that the more you do something, the better at it you usually become. I'm not saying there's not points of frustration. It's the more you really put yourself into it, you apply your concentration, you learn so much in that process, it becomes something that is open and undefined. And in time, that natural concentration, which is the real natural inquiry into being and seeing what's here, rather than just looking at things with snapshots of prejudice. In other words, I know what this is. I know what this is. It's like, well, no, you know, this is new. How can this be lived to the best of my ability? And then he goes, what need is there for a person's concentrated effort? So the rest of it, he really begins to address this too. And then he brings in another koan. He goes, indeed, the whole body is far beyond the world's dust. Now, this is referring to the Six Ancestors, a poem that he did, apparently, where the fifth ancestor realizes that, he has some wisdom there. And so somebody puts out the mind is like a bright mirror. Polish it from time to time. And don't let the dust stick. And so, I mean, that's paraphrasing. It may have missed a bit, you know, but just take it for what it is. And then the sixth ancestor comes up, well, that's not right, you know. And he goes, well, the mind is not a bright mirror, or the stand of a bright mirror. From the very beginning, there is nothing for the dust to stick to. You know, again, it's not very poetic and it's not directly accurate, but it's close. So there's these two aspects at play in us as human beings, and I'm not saying it doesn't, you know, just stick to a certain time. We see those same dynamics being played out over and over. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from one right where one is. You know, and again, is that can we really believe that? You know, I hear over and over, well, I'm going to go off to, you know, Green Gulch, or I'm going off to see Genpo Roshi, and then I'm going to practice very diligently there. You know, it's a bit like the statement in AA where they say, I'm going to do a geographical. In other words, when I go there, it's going to be a lot better. It's going to be easier in that way. But always practice resides in the place that one is. It's not in a different place. Then he goes on a bit further. What is the use going off here and there to practice? And he brings that up a bit later. And so we've got to look at that. You know, again, is quite often there are some places we regard as easier to practice because we also have prejudice on what success is and what failure is. You know, it's got to look like something rather than in the midst of difficulty, it is difficult in that way. I remember, you know, when Zen Center was going through a difficult time, Maizumi Roshi, instead of being a, you know, like a snake oil salesman, he goes, when it's hard, it's hard. You know, it's true. It's not that, you know, you put the Mr. Rogers smile on, you know, and the sweater, and then everything's going to be okay. No, as you feel those things, you acknowledge it, then you can deal with it directly. But knowing at the same time that all human states are transitory. But again, in our minds, we try and make them universal. I am this way, and it is always going to be this way. But as even if you watch your thought process, you'll see that that's not true. But our minds love to do certain things. Now, it's up to us not to really believe in those things, that universalize things that are passing, again, difficulty, ease, etc. No, this is the way it is, and it is the way it is because it is this way. You know, now how to deal with this, and then we become a lot more practical in terms of what practice is. So when we're happy, then what do? Usually with happiness, it's a no-brainer. You know, it's not that Zen doesn't deal with it. It's we don't talk about it because when we're happy, we're happy. You know, we don't go, oh, I'm happy. Damn. You know, very rarely do I hear that from people. So again, you know, what is the use of going off here and there to practice? So all of us do it. You know, Dogen went to China. You know, and he's the one that's writing about this. I came 6,000 miles from England to practice in a practice center. We do it, but it's still good advice. You know, in that way, yeah. Go to places where you get encouraged. Go to those places, but then if you do that and you come back to the place that you live, etc., is apply what you've learned. Don't wait to go back there again. You know, that's very much like the story of the hunter, the rabbit, and the stump, which is a hunter goes out and he spends all day hunting, and he just can't get anything, and so he comes back, and it's about 5 o'clock. It's just getting dark, and he just leans against the tree, exhausted, and his wits end. And this rabbit just runs out really fast, boom, right into a stump, dead. And he's going, oh, supper, you know. So he gets the rabbit and he takes it home, and then what does he do? He comes back the next day and he leans against the tree and he waits for another rabbit to run into the stump. And that's what we do as human beings. Rather than, you know, I mean, it's not the perfect example, but if you see that practice is here and now, practice here and now. Don't wait for some other time or place to do that. Again, Dogen's practice, this realization, no matter whether it's easy or difficult, not a realization that someone has had in the past. You can't gauge that. You can take it as encouragement, but then the realization of this moment in time. And again, with that realization, don't take it as a pointed realization that, aha, I saw this, and then conjure it up in that way and bring it back. Is no, look through the eyes, hear through the ears, experience this world. This is realization. You're making real or allowing realization to naturally unfold as your life or your living on a momentary basis. And then, you know, this is the beauty of Dogen. He doesn't stay on that one side. He goes, and yet, if there is the slightest discrepancy, in some translations, even if there is a hair's breadth of difference, you know. So if you pull one of those out, if you got any left, you'll see that's pretty thin. There's a discrepancy, you know. He goes, the way is as different as from heaven and earth. Again, you know, question that. If you haven't actualized it, which is one of the two major meanings of koan, if that hasn't actualized in your life, then that's the thing to do. If you're always drifting off and then forgetting who you are, what realization is, what practice is that you make it so. And then what is practice? Again, the core of practice is to be present to whatever is here. That actually includes a lot of people. Well, I do that, you know. But then part of that is you also look at the things that spoil it. You know, we all have a list of things that would make my practice a lot easier and a lot nicer. But are those really happening at this moment in time? You know, the one place that we have some control in that way is how we be at this moment in time. If I constantly allow my narrative, my story of myself, and my ways that I think that life should be come front and center, then I suffer for that. Because reality is always showing me this is the way it is. This is realization in itself. Once you map out the way that you use your mind to get in your own way, then it becomes more and more difficult to reintroduce it in that respect. And practice is then occurring, you know, on a momentary basis. And then, you know, he sort of goes on, and these are all the things that he's seen with people practicing at his time. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. Now, again, this is a koan. This is, you know, directly from a piece of writing done by Master Sozan Sozan from the 3rd, 4th century. he did a thing called the Shinshin Ming, or faith in mind or heart. And he goes, if the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. And there is a slight, you know, caveat here is that it's not, well, more than likely I'll always like blue over green, that kind of like or dislike. It's like the disliking of this moment in time that's occurring. I like it when I'm sitting. I don't like it when I'm walking, you know. And then we pretty soon start to aim towards those things. Or I like it when my mind is at peace and I don't like it when it's not. And so then we begin to practice things that aim towards other things rather than really swallowing this moment in time whole. And we get lost in confusion, which is true. Now, it goes on, and again, we see this with people. Suppose one gains pride of understanding and inflates one's own enlightenment, you know, inflates, you know, we know that. Get a pump, and it gets bigger. You know, you can instead of thinking of a ball, think of your head, you know, at some point. And we see that around us all the time. And hopefully we see it in ourselves as well. We get big headed, you know, I'm enlightened. This is great. Yeah. Just all these people think this of me, you know. And what's that really got to do with this moment in time? You know, it's just, hey, you know. And it, again, it's a waste of energy on many ways. Then he goes, glimpsing the wisdom that runs through all things. You know, and again, we have that. We value those insights. We really do. But if we hold on to them, it becomes a problem. Then it becomes difficult, again, to really see the world as it is. It's more like, well, I've got this insight. I've had this realization, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and like Ganto said to Seppo, he goes, that which comes through the gate, or the gate of the senses, is not the family treasure. You know, what you already are is this now, and it contains everything there. It doesn't matter about the intellectual realizations that you have. It's really being at home in this world, this untrammeled world that he's talking about. So again, he's talking about traps that we have, and also continuous practice. Don't keep holding on to these things because, you know, we get in trouble, mainly with ourselves, but obviously with the people around us too. Attaining the way and clarifying the mind, raising an aspiration to escalate the very sky. Okay, well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with these things in many ways. Without aspiration, then, you know, quite often we can get stuck. Clarifying the mind is very useful. But if we get attached just to clarity, sometimes life is very gray. It's, you know, it's not so clear. Clarity, unclarity. Sometimes it's mixed. Sometimes it's so 50-50. It's just a matter of making a choice. But part of it then is just understanding how the mind works, how we place value in terms of our own living. Like people will say over and over, you know, my Zazen was just so busy. It wasn't good. And then, you know, I hear the quotes of like my own teacher. He goes, I am, you know, these days my mind is so busy. But he didn't say it as a complaint. He just said it as a fact. You know, simply he was running the center, he had all these different things going, he had a family, but it didn't get in the way. It's not that there's this clarity there all the time. It's that whatever is there, thoroughly immerse yourself in it. And sometimes that clarity is not just your clarity, it's also the clarity or unclarity of the people around you. As you know, we say that to ourselves is that we enter into, say, a room and it's got a certain ambience and a certain feeling. We may like it or dislike it or whatever. But that's our life at that particular moment. We can abdicate that responsibility and want it a different way. But the truth is that's the way it is. If we deal with it, not only are we dealing with this, but we're also helping to deal with that is around us. There's no need to attach ownership to those kinds of experiences. Let's see, where are we? One is making the initial partial excursions. So it talks about the aspiration right after that. One is making the initial partial excursions around the frontiers, you know. But is still somewhat deficient in the vital way of total emancipation. So it's again, it's not just these things. Now, what is total emancipation too? In the West, we love the word freedom, but what is that? Really? How do you really define it? Because when I hear it, well, I'm free to do anything that I want. Yeah, on one level, but there's always the other aspect. Are you willing to take the consequences? Now, that's freedom if you can take the consequences. It's not just, well, I'm leaving, I'm done, you know, I'm good there. Just like had a guy come into a Dharma talk one day, and he goes, he left, you know, after about 10 minutes. And he goes, I'm free to leave. And I looked up at him, and I went, you're free to stay too. You know, there's no defining it in that way. The freedom is that I take full responsibility for this action. You know, I'm free to do that. You know, freedom is that realization. You're not trapped. In other words, there's that untrammeled aspect that we have as human beings. And even in the human aspect where we are, say, trapped with a position or we're trapped in whatever, you've got to see the freedom within that too, as human beings. I've seen prisoners that have been emancipated and not let free from the prison, but freeing themselves and helping people around them. It's not a matter of your external circumstances, but can you be free in the circumstances in your own karma? I'm going to say that, the way that you've lived, the situation you're in that respect. And, you know, I think he's kind of understating that, but you're still somewhat deficient in the way of total emancipation. Deficient. Something's lacking. And again, there's always going to be something lacking if the mind is dwelling elsewhere. At some point, there is that process, or that point where you swallow yourself whole. You know, this is the way I am as a human being. Some things I like, some things I don't like. It doesn't get any better than this. Why? Because I've tried for 6, 8, 9 years. This is the way I am as a human being. But even saying that, that's not fixed. Up to now, this is who I am. But it's not defined and it's not made up of words. You know, it's not made up of words. The world is always like this. And it appears as it appears in that respect. Then he goes into encouraging examples from the past, which we do as human beings. I mean, it's worthwhile having that that reflection. Who were your heroes? Who encouraged you? Who did you look back to in history and wish to actualize, you know? And it doesn't mean they have to be of the same class or the, you know, the same religion or same sex, anything like that. Who really encouraged you? What stories really encouraged you? I mean, the Buddha is one for me, you know, definitely. You know, as a human being, a lot of people will say, well, he was a prince, you know, he had it made. How could he leave? You know, how could he leave that kind of life? You know, I mean, literally, how could he leave? What do they do with a prince? Because if somebody gets hold of him from another country, you know, if he tries to be a teacher in his own town, what happens? I mean, we've all, you know, tried to teach things in our own town. You go back and you go, oh, that's just Chaz from when, you know, I know him, you know, he used to be a stoner. You know, and they just, you know, you can't do anything because you're already in a box. So the Buddha had to go somewhere else and do something. And he had to go in a place that would support somebody of a different royal family, because can you imagine what would happen to them? And you're an ally of those things. That's not easy. And all the intrigue that would go around that. He was trained as a warrior. How'd you get past that? In privilege. And he wasn't living it with privilege in those things. And you reflect that back on your own life and your own limitations that you've had through your own upbringing, your own karma. And yet, you know, despite the fact for 6 years he started trying to be the best of the best of not eating and sitting until he was so emaciated he falls in the stream. We know the rest of the story. And then finally he goes, I'm stopping this displacement activity. I am going to sit here until I really realize the way and realize his initial questioning. That is the core of it. But then that's just the start of it. 40 years he continues to teach. 40 years. You know, that's how much he valued it. And it's not now, well, now I've got the badge of being a teacher. It's not first, he was a practitioner. And so then is that continued for that for the entire 40 years of his life. I'm not going to get through this, so I'll probably, you know, do another couple, I think. And you know, what he's saying is true. The influence of his 6 years of upright sitting is noticeable still. Not only 6 years, but the 40-some years until he died is noticeable still. And that's why Buddhism has such power. So for 2,500 years, the effects of that person's efforts in their life has been passed down. And so it's been that strong and that pertinent to people until till the present day. I don't care if he's a historical figure. I don't care if he's old and stuffy in that way. He did what he needed to do. And if I can learn anything, that's exactly what I would learn from the Buddha. This is it. Do the best that you possibly can and carry it on and pass it on in that way. So I think I'll close it at that, that part, and then we can go on next week.
You're now able to unmute yourselves and use the raise hand function if you'd like to ask a question. And if there are questions in the room, you can just raise the hand.
Oh, and there's also a shorter version of this in Moon in a Dewdrop, but it's, you know, it was more like the original one that Dogen brought over from China when he was about 25, I think, 25, 26. I think you're sticking on the first line. Why training in enlightenment differentiates since the truth is universal.
Yeah.
Galen, you're on. Yeah. Morning.
So, I realize, you know, that there's, I guess it's probably a positive thing as much as negative, but there's this, you know, constant self-evaluation that, you know, that sense of something is lacking. Yeah. I realized when you were talking today, you gave a class, a series of classes back a few years ago about what was it? It was to potential teachers or something like that. And at some point, you asked a question that after, you know, after this realization or whatever it is, what's left? And the answer seemed to come up, habit energy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, and I've been, I keep being confronted with the fact that I didn't get here as a teenager, and I had years of, creating habits that are, man, these are dragons. These are you know, you can find yourself just acting habitually without, you know, while trying to not think about it, not analyze it, try to be right on point with what's going on. But at the same time, it's that. So I don't know where my question is. I think it has to do with, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is true. You know, is that, I mean, this constant practice in the sense of if I see something either here or there, it's important to do something about it. Because if not, those things will be perpetuated in one way or another. When I have a conviction of some of my own disease and et cetera, is that sometimes I've got to make a commitment to myself, is don't go there. Don't do that. Don't practice it. I remember one particular time in my own history, it's almost like driving a nail through my foot into the ground. Stay here. Don't go there. You know where it leads. And after a few years of doing that, is that then this moment in time became so much more clear because I wasn't practicing futurizing. That was my main thing. When I become, when people come, when I get some respect, when, you know, rather than, no, I'm living now, live it, do it, learn from it, you know. And so then it's that practicing the futurizing, which is usually a problem for us as human beings. Look at advertising.
Yeah.
I mean, the most of it is that you will be something when you have something. You know, if you have this, which is really valuable, you get that and you know it's never enough. So at some point it's like, no, I'm not going there. That's one of the best ways of practicing the so-called Hinayana. You just say, no, I'm not going there for a period of time. And you don't have to say, I'm not going to go there for the rest of my life, because for me, that doesn't work. That's like, you know, putting up a red flag for a bull. It's no, for a month, I'll try this. Or what's usually better is 3 months, because I usually can't hold on to 3 months. I can do a month, but not three, you know. And I learn stuff in that embodiment cycle of 3 months. Yeah. And usually if I do that, I'm happier with my life. If it doesn't work, I can throw it away.
That makes a lot of sense to me. The toughest thing for me is dealing with habits that I sincerely believe are constructive.
Yeah.
When I'm confronted with someone or ones that have come to that place that you're talking about, this is who I am, this is I like, you know, and they're happy with where they are, and you see them just walking into wall after wall after wall, and and you go, wait a minute, you know, I want to turn you this way, keep you from bumping, and they go, get away from me, I'm making my own decision.
Yeah.
You know, so my habit is to try to keep them from bumping into walls, and to try to back away from that thing that seems to be logical and good for me. It's like pulling teeth, you know. It's tough. It's hard to break.
Yeah.
What's going to happen.
Well, it is, and it can be done. You know, the thing is, if you don't do something about it, then what? You know, if you do something about it, then what?
Then I wound up suffering more too, you know, if I don't do something about it.
Well, exactly. So then, you know, I mean, usually we use suffering to be a change, a vehicle for change. Quite often we don't suffer enough. When we suffer enough with something, we'll do anything to get through it. You know, but suffering is not just a negative, it's a mechanism for change. You know, and the thing is, what Dogen's talking about here, he's talking in this case more about the individual practice of say thought or habitual habit energy or impulse energy. Is that as we know, the more you notice it, the more you acknowledge it. At some point, is that you have to do something about it because you see the same result happening. But that might take some time, but. Again, habit and impulse are two of the biggest, but even that doesn't get in the way. If you know, once you realize that this is it, That may perpetuate, but this is always underneath. You know, you're always at home and you see it for what it is. It's just ideas around that there is something else that would be nice to have or become in that respect. But I mean, just when you watch advertising next time, is just look at what they're doing and what that strikes, you know, in yourself, because we do that to ourselves too. That's why it's so powerful.
Yeah, that always appeals to your self-interest, to your greed.
Yeah, exactly. Or your or image.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very subtle, but
self-interest. Well, subtle, and sometimes it's really gross too. You know, it's really obvious. And, you know, it's yeah. You get these pants and you look like, I don't know, Mick Jagger or someone. Well, maybe not Mick Jagger now, but, you know. And you know it's not true, you know. Thank you. Right, Deanne, you're on.
Yeah, thank you for this. Thank you for your forthrightness, Galen. I've been really struggling too with things that are deeply ingrained that I keep coming back to. And I realized it's when I'm feeling the most uncertain or the most apprehensive about something. And I'm realizing that unless I can bring compassion to myself in looking at those things,
yeah,
they become even more entrenched.
Yeah.
If I approach them in a way where I'm separating myself from them, mm-hmm. like that's not the way I should be. That's not the way I am anymore, in quotes. I create that separation and I start to objectify myself. Like the compassion that I would bring to someone else who's grappling with something like that would come pretty automatic.
Yeah.
Well, I can pretty judgmental of others also. But I catch myself sooner being judgmental of others than I do of being judgmental about myself. And I'm realizing how that judgment creates a separation. And I'm wondering if maybe not to just reflect off what you said, Galen, but when you say that, I like the way you personify the habits, you know, that they start saying, to heck with you, I'm doing what I want. Mm-hmm. Because I'm thinking, you know, you almost construct something that you can butt up against instead of just looking at the whole of it. And like you were saying, Roshi, is this creating more suffering for myself? Or less, or is this how I want to serve? Just like serve myself. I mean that in an unselfish way.
Yeah. I get you. Yeah.
Serve myself. Mm-hmm. Because I can't serve other people if I'm not serving myself. If I'm creating some kind of see, now I'm starting, this is where words start to break down.
Yeah.
I can feel a mean, but it's difficult to articulate it.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, part of it is that when we feel a certain way, it's really going to the feeling rather than the intellectual story that surrounds it. And then, you know, quite often is that the feeling takes care of it, or it reveals something that is the real issue that is not being looked at, you know.
What I've done, this is something fairly recent now that I'm grappling with a couple of things that is put away the analysis and the trying to figure out why.
Yeah.
Simply try the other thing.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a lot of resistance within me.
Mm-hmm.
But don't separate out that resistance. Like, that's not me either.
Yeah, exactly.
It is. Be compassionate for that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Also be compassionate of the effort to even try to look at to do it differently, embody it differently. But it's that embodiment. I have to stick with the uncomfortableness long enough to embody something different so that I can experience what that change is.
Yeah.
Rather than thinking about the change.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, to experience the change and become the change.
Yeah, the direct experience, and that's important, again, because over time you see that the story doesn't really do much. It actually usually perpetuates the feeling. So there's that old Buddhist scheme, which is thought becomes emotion, emotion becomes thought, but you don't need to engage one into the other. You can feel one and do it. You can feel the other and do it. But with feeling, quite often, because we had this before we had this, is that if you have a gut feeling about something or a feeling about something, is the return to that, because it's had, you know, many more millions of years of experience than the head has. The head is really good at figuring things out, but a lot of things can't be figured out. They have to be experienced out. And the thing is, if you allow that to occur quite often, you will move quicker through those things, because again, is that we're far more experienced with emotion, but we don't trust it, because thinking, you know, we've created, you know, bombs and split the atom. We've done all this creation and stuff like that, but we, as human beings, we can't deal with the basics of our own emotions and feelings that drive us to do all kinds of stuff. But if you begin to do that, is that even when you're in the midst of an argument with somebody, you can stay centered on how you want to live, even because you focus on telling the truth about the actuality of the thing, and you don't get caught up in the narrative that's trying to draw you in. It's not, this isn't right to me. I'm, you know, it doesn't feel good or whatever. And even in those difficult situations, it becomes a lot easier to really be yourself in that, and also see where the other person's coming from and address their issue rather than their narrative.
With this practice helps so much in that, see a habit or a way of thinking or feeling about something come back again. And rather than pushing it away and going like, I thought you were over that, you know, which is not compassionate at all.
It's also not compassionate. It's not reflective of reality. You always got to remember that, is because, like, for myself, is that I'll say to myself, I've mastered this. But then I always say up to now, because I don't know when that's going to come back in whatever way. I have no idea.
Yeah.
In that way, I've mastered this much, but I don't say I'm done with it. You know, I hear that over and over with people, and then they're embarrassed later on because there it is. Yeah. So far, so good.
With the practice, I feel like it's like these turns in a spiral, though, that it feels like a little bit more in the center of the spiral instead of flying out here in some wide
horizon. Yeah, and again, the more you practice it, the more you confirm yourself as this, rather than the ideas of that and how you could be, you know. It's like when Dogen's talking about, you know, practice realization, there's nothing else really. But what we tend to do is that we practice our habits, our impulses, our thought patterns. And when that doesn't gel with reality, then we suffer because it doesn't feel right, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's so important to put the effort into really studying being and really being and seeing how it operates. And at the same time, we see how thought operates and where it leads to. So it's just like it's out in the open, and then I don't need to go there. Now, in saying this, I sound like I'm an expert, but, you know, I'm like anybody. It's just like when it's live and it's happening, it's that then it's the way it is. But the training helps in that way. To get a result that doesn't create too much division, it helps more towards unity.
Thank you, Roshan.
Thank you. All right, Terry and Penny, you're on.
Morning, Roshan.
Morning.
Thank you for the talk. This is kind of fuzzy in my head, but He starts out, Dogen here, and then the fascicle starts out talking about Zazen, and then like
ends with Zazen. Talking about it a lot.
Pardon?
And ends with Zazen.
And then he goes into like you talk a lot about everything is practice, realizing this at this moment and doing this moment and not being any separation of between everything in us or what right now. And then he, like, he ends this with some technical or tips about how to do Zazen.
Yeah.
But did I miss it? Does he ever say in the fascicle how Zazen helps us do all the other stuff he's talking about, like not being a hair's breadth difference?
Well, I mean, you know, he says things like, it's not a matter of sitting or lying down. You know, he talks about that.
Yeah.
You know, okay, then, yeah. You know, so I appreciated what you were saying. So let me do an overview quickly of what it is. You know, basically the first one is the intrinsic part. We're fine the way we are. As like Suzuki Roshi would say, but we could do with a bit of work. You know, he would say that.
Yeah.
So, but then he goes, if there is a gap, which is calling in itself, then that needs to be bridged, you know, between yourself and yourself, basically. And then he goes on to examples. So he talks about the Buddha and he talks about Bodhidharma. So these are examples from the past. And then he goes, and then he says an overview of Zazen, which is you should cease from practice based on intellectual understanding. Now, he says based on intellectual understanding. He doesn't say you shouldn't think about this stuff. It's just a practice isn't. It's placed on being, which is far beyond intellect. Intellect helps, right, but it's not there. And then he says some overviews about what you should do before Zazen, which a lot of people don't talk about nowadays. Like, now, what here he uses, instead of Zazen, he uses the word Sanzen, which is not what they say in the Rinzai school, for Dogsan. That's a word for Dogsan. But in this case, it's called it's penetrating Zen. So we're penetrating into Zen. He says a quiet room, you know, eat and drink moderately. So you'll know if you've had too much to eat or drink, you know, it's not easy sitting. So he's just saying something, you know, like Yasutani Roshi would always say, never exceed 2/3 of your capacity in terms of food, you know. And then he goes, and he's talking about the mental things. Do not think good or bad. Cease involvement in all kinds of mental activity. Really good advice, you know. I mean, it's do not administer pros and cons. Well, Zazen's good or bad. This is good or bad Zazen. Don't go there. You know, you can do that after you finish. You know, it's just like, don't cloud yourself up unnecessarily. So he gives you all of this good stuff. I'm going to talk about it later, so I'm not going to get into it too much. Then he says it's good to find a quiet place, sit down, do some transition practices, which a lot of people don't do. Just plonk on the seat and thinking continues, you know. Same process, same thing, you know. And then he does all of that. And then he goes, okay, then sit. Now deal with the mind. So first, get your breathing, get your posture straight. And then dealing with the mind basically is think of not thinking, he says, you know, which again is a koan. I'm not going to go into it. And he goes, the Zazen I'm speaking of is not learning meditation. Aha. Most people on this planet think that. He says it's simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss. So he's defining it now. He's going, so this place is the gate. And like a gate, there's an inside and an outside. So you can stand and you can stand looking at this from the outside and going, yeah, I'm doing the sitting. Or you can enter in to that thing where you're not constantly valuing whatever your Zazen is, etc. Anyway, yeah. I'm doing an overview. So he's done the description. And he goes, if you do this, you'll be like a tiger when they go into their natural habitat. You know, like me, the couch, my Barker lounger, my natural habitat. I'm home. You know, the dragon when he reaches the water. You know, in that way, you'll be at home. It's great. You know, it's not the thing, oh, a tiger, I'll be like a tiger, munch on things and people, you know. Then he says how to get up. So that mind is continued into walking or whatever. Then he talks about koan. And he goes, things will trigger you in your life. You know, like you might see something, it's just like wakes you up to something. I'm sure you've had that. And that's just because your awareness is there and you see it, you know, in that way. So he talks about triggering. And then it's not about being intellectual or not intellectual. You know, it's nothing to do with if you're smart or dull. And it's true. Mm. You know?
Yeah.
Well, there we go. And then it's not just in India and China. For him, there's Japan too. And then for us, it's India, China, Japan, America, Europe. You know, it's not contingent on your nationality. Like when I first thought, you know, I can't get enlightened because I don't look like a Oriental person or an Asian person. I don't look like that. So you can't even assign that it looks like something in that way. It only resides in. But those are the things that we do. We tend to project things on. And then he goes, this is interesting. You have attained the pivotal opportunity of a human being. Pivotal, a pivot even, you know. And that's the place where the force lies. And what is that? You know, that's this moment in time. Past is no good to me. What I've done in the past is no good to me. And the future isn't here yet. The only place where this a pivot is here. And this is a human being right here now. Interesting thing, he doesn't say it's great being a human, you know. I mean, he might have talked about dogs, you know, and to a dog going, you've reached the pivotal opportunity of being a schnauzer. You know. But so how do you use this pivot that you have as a human being? This is where the changes are made. We can even erase some of our familial karma by looking at those patterns and help out that entire line that's come down to you in that way. And then, so, you know, he goes on, don't get caught up in little things. And then in the end, don't doubt your true nature. You know, so there's so much in this whole thing. And then don't waste your time. You know, you'll if you do these things, it'll naturally occur to you as a human being. So.
The key part of what you just talked about was answered my question. San, because I didn't pick up on the meaning of that, but this for the look. What do you say? Appearing and looking into the mind of Zen.
Yeah.
So once you said that, it made sense how he ties Zen. I mean, I know the values of Zen through experience. I mean, I read about it first.
Yeah. Exactly.
Assumed it had some value, but then I found out for myself it does.
Yeah.
So,
and that's important. You don't need to dwell there. You know it works, you know. If people want you to prove it for them, you never can, but at least you can say something.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just trying to tie it together in my mind, mm-hmm. how he tied it together, and that Sansen seems to be, for me,
the key. Now, for instance, if Maizumi Roshi was talking about Dogen, you know, sometimes he would do a whole week on, say, the Fugen Zazengi or the, maybe not something quite as simple as that, but, you know, way of everyday life or wholehearted activity. He would call it, say, Shobo Genzo, a Sankyo, which is the treasury of the true Dharma eye, penetrating the sutras, or, you know, that's there. So that's what they would call him. It's that San that is being used in this one, which is more the mind of study, seeing what that means. And study, obviously, it's not just a studying that out there. The study is how you see that's operating in your own life, and where you feel what he's saying doesn't match at this point in time. Yeah. Don't just swallow stuff you don't understand. It's just let that be the colon that works with you. Because yeah. There's lines, you know, there's lines in this that don't always, you know, stick. I don't believe them, put it that way. And it could be translation too, even though I know that these were good translators that did this. Like things like, let's see. The right Dharma is manifesting itself, and that from the first dullness and distraction are set aside. That's kind of like 50-50 to me.
Mm. Yeah,
I mean, dullness and distraction don't get in the way. I can see it taken in that way, but it doesn't mean they disappear. Yeah. When you're dull, you're dull. You know, it's just like no use being something else, just dull. But then you experience it, you learn from it. Distraction, sometimes we're distracted, but again, is that you learn from it, etc. In that way. But there is that aspect of, you know, is that when I be, that is what's going on. And it includes all of those different human states that are there. But that's the thing, is that you can't just swallow it. It's just like, what's he talking about? Because sometimes it doesn't gel with the way that I look at it. But I can see that he could be saying something in a certain way.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.